So.
All right, good afternoon. Today is April 5th, 2017, 3 p.m., the wonderful Senator Steiner Hayward's birthday. Woo-hoo. And in honor of her birthday, we are going to open our subcommittee on public safety.
Yay.
And continue our public hearing on House Bill 5015, Department of Justice. So on that note, take it away.
Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am the Deputy Attorney General.
Thank you very much.
The Attorney General is at the Supreme Court this afternoon and sends her regrets, so you will have me. This afternoon we will have a presentation from our Appellate Division. The Solicitor General, Ben Gutman, is here to give the presentation. Then he will be joined by Steve Lippold, who is our Chief Trial Counsel, who they will present on the Defense of Criminal Convictions group. And finally, we will wind up with the Trial Division. And if you don't mind, since Mr. Gutman and Mr. Lippold essentially sing a duet here for a while, I'm going to just sit back and let Mr. Lippold come up, and then we can proceed swiftly.
I just want you guys to know I'm impressed with the size of the crowd that you've brought out today.
Sure know how to clear a room.
Yep. Thank you.
My goodness.
Co-Chair Stark, I'm Benjamin Gutman, the Solicitor General, which means that I am the head of the Appellate Division at the Department of Justice. Our core mission is representing the state's interests in any cases that go beyond the trial level. And if I could just start out by explaining why that is so important. The rulings by these appellate courts not only decide the particular case in front of them, but they also set precedent for all similar cases in the future. Our job is to make sure that the court understands the broader ramifications of the issues that are in front of it, and to make arguments that are not just in the state's interest in this particular case, but that are in the best interests of the state overall. Of course, if we don't respond to an appeal or if we don't respond adequately, we run the risk that the court misunderstands the issues or doesn't see the best arguments for a position and then makes a mistaken ruling that harms the state's interests, not just in that case, but potentially in other cases like it as well. So all of the appellate courts that we work in operate fairly similarly. They generally expect both sides to submit detailed written briefs laying out their arguments, and then they hold an oral argument that's much like one of these hearings where the judges have opportunities to ask questions, make sure they understand the cases, and explore the implications of the party's arguments. Most of our work in the Appellate Division is in preparing these legal briefs and preparing and then presenting oral arguments. The state is a party to the vast majority of the cases in the state appellate courts, so we're very familiar with those courts and what kind of help they're looking for from the parties in deciding the cases. Many of our lawyers also clerked for appellate courts after law school, and so have a keen understanding of how those courts approach the cases that they hear. We also do a few other things that don't directly involve cases on appeal, and I'll just mention two right here. First, in death penalty cases, the Appellate Division's lawyers not only handle the appeals, but also trial proceedings in which the inmate is challenging the conviction or sentence. Just as an example, earlier this year, we had an 8-day trial here in Salem about whether Christian Longo received adequate legal representation at his original criminal trial, where he was on trial for murder of his family. A second thing that we do is that we prepare the ballot titles for legislative referrals to the voters or citizen initiatives. These are the materials that appear directly on the ballot to explain to the voters what the measure is about and what the consequences will be if the measure is approved. This next slide shows you our organizational structure. The Appellate Division is headed by a Solicitor General and a Deputy Solicitor General. And the rest of our work is essentially organized into three different practice areas: criminal appeals, post-conviction challenges to criminal convictions and sentences, and civil and administrative appeals. Now, last week, I believe you heard from my counterpart in the Public Defender's Office, Ernie Lannett, and he described their work as a high-volume appellate practice. I think that's an excellent description of what we do as well. Just keep in mind that in addition to the 1,400 or so cases we do every year where the Public Defender's Office is on the other side, we also have 600 or more additional cases that we do where there are other lawyers on the other side. So we have an even broader range of the kind of work that that we do. Most of our 40 attorneys are generalists who do some work in all three of our different practice areas. Many of them do have specialties in one or more of those areas. We also have 17 staff members, paralegals, legal secretaries, and the like, who are really crucial. We have a very heavy caseload, and they're really crucial to making sure that that we are able to get our work done. We get an avalanche of paper filings and electronic filings, and they ensure that the right filings get to the right people, and that we don't miss our deadlines, and that we don't lose our files. And it's a very efficient operation, and I don't think our lawyers could handle the volume of cases that they have without that assistance. The first two practice areas that I mentioned, the direct criminal appeals and the post-conviction cases, fall under the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program. We're going to talk about that next, so I'm going to set those cases aside for now and focus on the third practice area, which is civil and administrative appeals, and then we'll come back to the DCC next. So civil appeals are cases where a state agency or officer is either suing or being sued by someone else. In most of these cases, somebody is trying to get money from the state or is trying to force the state to take a particular action. The vast majority of these appeals are cases they're appeals that we're responding to. In other words, they're cases where the trial court has already ruled that the state acted properly or that the opposing party is not entitled to the relief they seek, and they're trying to get the Court of Appeals to change that ruling. So unless we agree that the Court of Appeals made a that the trial court made a mistake, we need to appear and to explain to the Court of Appeals why it should uphold the trial court's ruling. The slide lists examples of some of the kinds of cases that fall under the category of civil appeals. For example, we have a tax case in which the dispute is over what formula to use to determine the income of a company that has income both in Oregon and in other states. The particular dispute in this case is over a requested tax refund of a few hundred thousand dollars, which is a significant amount of money, but the decision in the case potentially implicates $100 million in pending requests for tax refunds. So it's obviously enormously important that the court get that right and that they'd hear the best arguments from the state about why it should rule the way that we think it should. The lawyers on the other side of the case are some of the foremost nationwide experts on multi-state taxation, and We have committed the resources to ensure that we have adequately responded to their arguments. Certainly not every case that we see has that broad an impact. But even when the cases are very fact-specific, we do try to make sure that the court gets the decision right, fully understands the facts of the case and the legal issues. Other categories of cases that we see include torts, which are cases where somebody is arguing that the state is responsible for an injury that they suffered, or disputes about whether a company has complied with its obligations under a contract with the state, or disputes about whether a child's living situation is safe, or cases where somebody argues that they don't have to comply with a particular state law because it's unconstitutional. So we have examples of all those different kinds of cases. The other category that falls in this practice area are administrative appeals, and these are cases where a state agency has made a decision and someone who's unhappy with that decision is trying to challenge it in court. Some of these cases bypass the trial courts and go directly to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Just some examples of the kinds of administrative decisions that might be challenged: a decision to take away a teacher's license because of inappropriate conduct with a student, a decision finding that somebody improperly disposed of hazardous waste, a decision about whether somebody qualifies for unemployment benefits. So there's a broad range of things that state agencies do that potentially affect people's lives. We also see rule challenges, which are cases where an agency has issued a rule on a particular matter, and somebody is arguing that that wasn't within the agency's authority to do it, or that they didn't follow the proper procedures. And again, it's important that we respond to these cases, because if we don't, the court might end up ruling that a teacher who shouldn't have a license is entitled to their license back, or that a company that's disposing of hazardous waste improperly can continue to do so. There are other kinds of cases that we have that don't fall neatly into those categories. These include some proceedings that are filed directly in the Oregon Supreme Court. One of those is challenges to the ballot titles that we prepare. If somebody thinks that we haven't adequately explained the measure or that we misunderstood what the measure will do, they can ask the Supreme Court to change the wording that will appear on the ballot. And when that happens, we will provide the Supreme Court with the materials that it needs to decide that and also explain why we chose the wording that we did. There are also mandamus proceedings, which are proceedings where somebody who's involved in a trial court litigation wants the Supreme Court to intervene and direct the trial judge to do something in that case. Sometimes the Supreme Court asks us to respond, and we'll explain what's happening in the trial court and why we think the Supreme Court should or shouldn't get involved. And then finally, we have we sometimes do amicus or friend of the court briefs. These are cases where the state is not a party, but the legal issue is one that's of importance to the state, and it's important for us to make sure that the court gets it right and hears the best arguments. We can file a brief explaining what the state's interest is and why the court should rule a particular way. This is an area where Oregon can and sometimes is a nationwide leader on important legal issues. For example, just earlier this year, we submitted a brief to the United States Supreme Court in a consumer protection case about abusive debt collection practices. 28 states joined our brief, which I think is a real cross-section of geographically and ideologically of different states across the country. And I think it's a testament to the really excellent work that the lawyers in our office did, that they were able to attract such a broad coalition of states to join us in this case. Just to give you a sense of what this workload is like, our 40 lawyers handle about 2,000 cases a year. Roughly two-thirds of them are related to criminal matters, and the last third are the civil and administrative and some of the other matters that we've been discussing. And again, in the vast majority of all of these cases, we're responding to an appeal that was brought by the other side, so we don't really have a choice about it. The court's going to decide the issue whether we appear or not, and so if the state either cares about the outcome of that case in particular or cares about the legal issue more generally, we have to be there and to devote the resources to convince the court to do the right thing. The last couple of slides here are about our policy option package and the potential impact of funding reductions on our work, and I understand we're going to be discussing that more at phase two. But certainly if there are any questions about anything that I've discussed, I'm happy to address it. And otherwise, I think we can move on to discuss the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program. Just to get started with this, the mission of the Defense of Criminal Convictions, or DCC program, is to ensure that people who are properly convicted of committing crimes in Oregon actually serve the sentences that have lawfully been imposed for those crimes. The DCC is essentially the program that pays for the work that our office does to defend those convictions and sentences. It's essentially a fund that pays for the lawyer, mostly lawyer time, is the main expense on that. I think the most important thing to know about this, and you'll see that this is similar to some of the things I've already been saying about our civil work, is that this is a mandated caseload, meaning that we don't really have control over how much work comes in or how complex that work is. People who are convicted of crimes have the right to challenge those convictions in a number of different ways that we'll be discussing, and when that happens, the state needs to respond if we want to uphold the conviction and the sentence, and if we believe that those are valid. We will also discuss a couple of other ways that the that we use the DCC funds to try to prevent problems up front that could lead to reversal of a criminal conviction down the road. This includes taking our own appeals when we think that a trial judge has made an incorrect ruling that jeopardizes a case. This also includes educating prosecutors and law enforcement around the state about how to ensure that they're complying with the law. And Mr. Whippold is going to talk about the trial division's work in front of the PSRB as well. We thought that it might be helpful to kind of walk you through the various ways that someone who's been convicted of a crime can challenge their conviction and seek to overturn it. This is a bit of a simplified version. Of course, there are many variations. And usually we would only get through this entire process that we're going to discuss in the case of a very serious crime with a lengthy sentence, like a Measure 11 crime, because we are talking about a process that potentially unfolds over years. But if you start on the left here, you'll see that the first thing is the case starts with a prosecutor, usually in a district attorney's office, bringing criminal charges against a person. Now, if the person is acquitted of the charges, that's the end of the matter. There's no appeals and no retrials or anything. If they're acquitted, that's it. So we're going to assume that the person is convicted of the crime and that they want to challenge that. The first step would be that the defendant can file an appeal with the Oregon Court of Appeals. The defendant can argue that something improper happened at trial, for example, that the jury heard evidence that shouldn't have come in front of the jury, or that the judge gave incorrect instructions to the jury about what the law that it was supposed to apply was. And we'll, of course, respond to those arguments and explain why the evidence was properly considered by the jury, or why the jury instructions were correct, or why none of this would have made any difference to the outcome anyway. Assuming that the Court of Appeals agrees with us and upholds the conviction, the defendant's next option would be to ask the Oregon Supreme Court to review the case. The Supreme Court has discretionary review, meaning it doesn't have to take the case, and in fact it takes a very small percentage of the cases, generally only ones that have a legal issue that's of importance, not just in that case, but to a whole range of cases. So I guess for present purposes, let's assume the Supreme Court denies review. At that point, the direct appeals are over, and the next opportunity would be back in the trial court. So I'll let Mr. Lippold take over.
All right. Chairman Stark, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lippold. I'm Chief Trial Counsel for the Oregon Department of Justice. I oversee the trial division. So as Ben just mentioned, this case is now completed at the appeal stage, and a convicted person has the opportunity to take another approach to gain some kind of relief from the conviction. In these cases, which we call post-conviction relief, these are cases that take place in state court and are based on state law. For example, a person may petition the court seeking relief, arguing that the trial counsel that he or she had during the criminal trial performed ineffectively, meaning that they failed to investigate certain things, failed to call certain witnesses that should have been called, failed to take up an approach that should have been taken. And this case then is presented to a trial court, whether it might be in Marion County, Umatilla County, or whatever. And it is the lawyers of the trial division that handle this case at the trial court level through litigation of motions or an actual trial itself. Once that is finished, the petitioner has the opportunity then to appeal the decision by the trial court in that post-conviction relief matter. And at that point in time, the case that was with the appellate court or appellate section, now with the trial section, now moves back to appellate.
And so we would take over at that point, and the first step again would be back to the Oregon Court of Appeals. And the question now would be, did the post-conviction trial court handle the proceeding properly? Did it properly rule on evidentiary issues? Did it properly decide the legal issues in front of it? And again, if the Court of Appeals sustains the conviction, the petitioner can ask the Oregon Supreme Court to grant discretionary review at that point. And once you've gotten through that process, the state proceedings about the validity of this conviction and sentence are over, and the next step would again be back in Mr. Lippold's shop.
Right, and at that point in time, we move to federal court options. The petitioner can petition the federal court, arguing much of the same arguments that were presented in the state court on post-conviction relief, but are now based on federal law, and those are cases we call federal habeas corpus cases. The trial division, again, handles those cases at the trial court level before the U.S. District Court, and once the decision comes down in that case, fortunately, most of the time, if not nearly all of the time, in favor of the state, the petitioner can then appeal the federal court decision to the Ninth Circuit Supreme Court or Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And that's where we would take over, and we would represent the state again in front of the Ninth Circuit. And again, the questions now would be, did the federal district court handle the case properly, rule correctly on the legal issues? And we will represent the state in those proceedings. And generally, if the conviction and sentence have made it through all of these stages and have been upheld, that should be the end of the matter. It should be definitively established that the conviction and sentence are final.
Yes. If I might, yes. Chair Stark and members of the committee, should be completed. It's important to know that some of these cases can go back and forth for years. They can file for post-conviction relief on other grounds as things change over time. They can file for federal habeas corpus relief over time as things change. One case that we've handled recently involved Frank Gable, who was convicted decades ago for the murder of the Department of Corrections Director, Mr. Frankie. Because of changes in DNA testing and what have you, Mr. Gable has again and again challenged his conviction, and we just spent quite a bit of time handling the trial court part of that case, and it's still before the court. So
our next slide is a pie chart that gives you a sense of how much of the DCC funding goes to support each of these stages that we've been talking about. And you'll see that roughly half of the funding goes to the direct criminal appeals, that very first stage on the previous chart. Of the remainder, more than half of it deals with the post-conviction trial proceedings that Mr. Lippold's shop handles, and then sort of a decreasing slice for every subsequent stage. And I think what this chart reflects is both that not all cases go through all of those stages, and so there are fewer cases at each stage, and also that in general, the trial work is more resource intensive than the appellate work. It's just the nature of the way these cases are litigated, so they end up with significant slices. So the next two slides talk about when we walked through the example of how a case, the life of a case in all these different stages, we were assuming at every stage that the conviction was and the sentence were upheld. Of course, that's not always the case. And the next two slides talk about some of the other possible outcomes. In a direct criminal appeal, if the court doesn't uphold the conviction and sentence, it has a number of options depending on what the nature of the error was. If the court says that the error was simply that there wasn't enough evidence to convict somebody of this crime, the court may reverse, and that again could be the end of the matter, like they were acquitted in the first instance. If the court thinks that something happened at trial that was unfair, like evidence came in that shouldn't have come in, the court can order a new trial. If the court thinks that that there was a problem with the sentencing, the court can order a new sentencing proceeding. So it really depends entirely on what the nature of the error is as to what remedy the court will award.
Again, Chair Stark, members of the committee, and these types of relief are the same for post-conviction relief cases and federal habeas corpus cases, where the court, if it chooses not to uphold the conviction before it, can also grant a new trial or a resentencing, just as Mr. Gutman has explained.
So until now, we've been talking mostly about our work where a criminal defendant is challenging their conviction or sentence. But there are a small number of cases every year in which we're the ones who think that a trial judge made a mistake, and we're seeking to correct that either in the Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court. These are often cases where a trial judge has ruled that the prosecution isn't going to be allowed to present certain evidence that we think is important to the case and that should come in. And the concern is that if the case goes forward without that evidence, there might not be the jury might not convict, and that again that would be the end of the of the possibility of holding the person criminally responsible. So, in some of those cases, we will decide that it's important enough that we will, before the criminal trial, appeal and seek to get a ruling that that evidence is in fact admissible. We are pretty selective about these cases. You'll see that we usually have a committee in my office that that looks at these cases and meets to discuss them. We consider about 30 to 50 a year, and we probably take 10 to 20 appeals. So it's not a huge portion in the context of the 1,200 or so direct criminal appeals that we do, but they tend to be very important cases, or we wouldn't be doing that.
Chair Stark, members of the committee, the DCC Fund also funds the work done by the trial division before the Psychiatric Security Review Board and the State Hospital Review Panel. The PSRB has jurisdiction over people found guilty except for insanity of a Measure 11 crime. It conducts hearings over whether these individuals should be conditionally released or discharged into the community. The State Hospital Review Panel, which we call the SHARP Panel, conducts hearings to determine whether patients charged with or convicted of non-Measure 11 crimes, who also were found guilty except for insanity, should be conditionally released or discharged into the community. The role of the trial attorneys. Do you have a question?
Yes, Senator I do. But if you want to finish your sentence or two, that's fine. Because you may answer my question.
You may go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. I chair the Human Services Subcommittee, so the PSRB and the State Hospital come under my budget aegis. And one of the questions that we've been asking is how different the PSRB reviews and the SHARP reviews are, and whether there's a reason to keep them separate or keep them together. And I'd be interested in your perspective as one of the attorneys involved or your team's involvement as to how the work that you all do in front of the PSRB is different or the same as how the work in front of the SHARP.
Well, Chair Stark, Senator Steiner Hayward, the work that is done before both panels is very similar, and that the goal of the trial division lawyers is to challenge whether or not a person ought to be released, and to do so, they're really pursuing the question of whether or not a person still has a mental disease or defect that would require that person to stay within the custody of the state hospital. So in both events, that's really the role of the trial division, is to push back against either the decisions or opinion of the state hospital doctors or the patient himself or herself who is trying to get conditionally released. So in that respect, I think that they're very similar. I don't necessarily see that they're different. The two panels were put together based on, first the PSRB was put into place to handle the Measure 11. And then the question became, well, what are we doing about the non-Measure 11? And rather than pushing it into PSRB, the State Hospital Review Panel was created to handle those cases. So I don't know that I really see a significant difference.
It's a matter of degree rather than kind.
I think so.
Thank you.
You bet. Anyway, as I just mentioned, the role of the trial division lawyers is to push back. The way that these cases come before the PSRB or the SHARP panel is either at a motion made by the state hospital itself that they believe that the person no longer suffers from a mental disease or defect and can be in the community safely, maybe under conditional release to a community care organization, or by a petition by a patient himself or herself arguing that they are no longer under a mental disease or defect. And so when we appear before the panel, we're often challenging either the medical opinions or the petitioner's own arguments that that person no longer suffers from a mental disease or defect. That's our role in those proceedings. And it is the DCC Fund which funds the work of our lawyers.
Chair Stark and members of the Commission, I mentioned at the beginning that the DCC also funds our efforts to prevent problems up front that could torpedo a criminal prosecution later. One way we do that is by answering calls from DA's offices around the state. The defense lawyer is making this argument. Is that right? And if not, what's our best response to that? Or the judge wants to know if the judge can do this thing. Can the judge do that? If the judge does it, is that going to be a problem for us on appeal? We get calls like this on a daily basis from prosecutors around the state. And because we have lawyers who have handled a lot of these issues and really thought about them in depth, they're often in an excellent position to advise the prosecutors on how to respond to these issues. We also send out weekly bulletins to prosecutors and law enforcement about recent decisions from the appellate courts. We try to highlight pitfalls that we think people might be able to avoid in the future, things that may have led to a problem in a past case. And we put together guides like our search and seizure manual that explain, try to synthesize the law in these areas. These are often areas where there are they're constantly evolving with new decisions, and we try to ensure that law enforcement and prosecutors around the state know what's expected of them and stay within the confines of the law so that we don't end up with a problem later in a criminal prosecution. And then again, our last slides show the requested funding increase that we have for the DCC program, as well as the effect of 5, 10, and 15% reductions. And I understand that that's going to be the subject of our phase two presentations. But of course, if there are any questions about any of that, happy to address them.
If I may, Co-Chair.
Go ahead.
Just for Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, just for clarification, the defense of criminal convictions is a general fund appropriation. It's not a specific account. So it varies in size depending upon caseloads. So the funding mechanism for the agency is the attorneys are other funded, but they charge against the defense of criminal convictions appropriation. So just minor clarification, Mr. Co-Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions or comments? All right.
All right.
Without the good co-chair here, you're getting off easy.
Thank you. Chairman Stark, members of the committee, again, Steve Lippold, Chief Trial Counsel for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'll stay seated here even though the slides are over to my right because I can't see Representative Sanchez if I sit over there. So, what is the trial division? What do we do? When the state is sued for money damages or when someone petitions the court asking for the state to do something, we're the division that handles those cases in civil court. They are the cases that you usually hear of involving cases of child sex abuse at DHS that involve inmate litigation. And things of that nature. The trial division is split up into three different sections. I need to see where
Just click anywhere, I think.
Just click anywhere. Oh, there we go. This slide shows how our organization is divided up. We have essentially three litigation sections. We have another section which houses the investigators and the division administrators. But the three sections of the trial division are the civil litigation section, the special litigation section, and the criminal and collateral remedies section. That's the that's the group of lawyers, paralegals, and staff that work on the DCC cases, which I just spoke about along with Mr. Gutman. So we'll try to abbreviate some of the conversation we have about that section. Anyway, it's the civil litigation section that handles a number of lawsuits that involve personal injury claims, property damage, wrongful termination, abuse of children in state custody, civil rights cases, acquisition of land for highway projects, and breach of contracts. Some of these cases can be varied and complex because of the way they're filed. just like the appellate section, we are really at, I wouldn't say the mercy, but we, our workload is controlled by others. In other words, people who sue the state. If people are suing the state must respond. Otherwise, a default judgment would be entered. The state would be on the hook, as many of these cases are filed for lofty amounts, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars. I just got one in today where a person is suing for $73 million, but I think that that's not a very likely outcome in that case. So,
sorry, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you one more time. Could you talk a little bit about the actual proportion? I mean, these requests for these huge judgments, are, you read about them in the paper all the time, and it's one of the conversations, especially after the Horton decision last year, that's come a lot up a lot about, is there an appropriate number that we should be thinking about, for, especially for non-economic damages? How does that, I mean, it may be not possible for you to give us any sense of percentages or anything like that, but could you talk a little bit about how that all plays out?
Well, I'll jump ahead to a slide here.
If you want to wait, that's fine too.
All right, let me address that in a couple of moments where we're
totally
talking
fine.
About kind of the numbers and how things play out.
Absolutely.
All right. So that's the civil litigation section. The special litigation section is a section of about 9 lawyers and additional paralegals and staff. They handle some of the more complex cases, class action cases, environmental claims. When certain statutes are challenged on the basis of whether or not they're constitutional, water law cases, things of that nature. And that is all housed in our special litigation section, which works out of our Portland office. Criminal and collateral remedies, again, we've talked about, and we've already gone through the kind of work that they do. To give you an idea of the complexity of some of these cases, is they're not always straightforward in terms of there's a the plaintiff is suing one actual agency or individuals within the agency. Currently, we're handling a case where a gentleman was accused of and tried for 22 counts of sex abuse of minors. The case was handled by the Tillamook County District Attorney's Office, and the trial ended in 5 of the counts being found not guilty, and 17 of them were hung, a hung jury on 17 counts. So this gentleman then sued the state and has a lawsuit pending that we are handling. He didn't just sue one part of the state. He sued DHS because DHS workers were involved in the protection of the children that were involved. He sued the state police because they investigated the allegations and passed their information along to the district attorney, and sued the deputy district attorney. We'll be suing the deputy district attorney who prosecuted him. So now we're dealing with 3 different state agencies right off the bat. In addition to that, the claims that the gentleman filed were both based on federal law and state law, and we're working with the law in both cases. But this is an indication of the fact that it might only show up on somebody's chart as one case, but it's really 3 cases in one, and it's a case that is going to take quite a bit of work in order to represent the state and represent the people that were sued. Now, let's move on to how we function with the different state agencies. Our section works closely with both state agencies who are being sued, which are being sued, and with DAS Risk Management. DAS Risk Management is, for all intents and purposes, the state insurance folks. They handle the payment of the legal fees and any judgments or settlements that are reached in civil cases. So when we have a case come in, as represented in the top left-hand corner of this slide, we work with the agency to develop information, to develop witnesses, to gather documentation, and to develop a trial strategy. But at the same time, we work with DASC Risk Management because we're looking at options. We're looking at, with the agency and DASC, what is the most appropriate way to handle this case, both efficiently and to reach a verdict in our favor or a resolution in our favor. In the bottom left-hand corner, you see that We have a number of cases that do not involve DAS risk management. DAS only works on the cases that involve the tort claims, personal injury, property damage, civil rights. Other agencies get sued for a variety of things, breach of contract, or they reached an order that a person is challenging and wants to get overturned by going to court. And so when we have those cases, the agencies themselves are paying our legal fees in what we do. Then on the right side, of course, is the DCC Fund, Criminal and Collateral Remedies, as we work with the DCC Fund to fund those cases. Our workload, the civil and special litigation section have about 800 cases pending at any given time. We have about 1,200 cases that come in each biennium. The criminal and collateral remedy section that we already discussed also has about 800 cases pending at any time, and 800 to 900 new cases come in each biennium. Now, getting to the question that you raised, Senator Steiner Hayward, this gives you this next slide gives you an idea of how successful we are in handling those cases. And I refer you to the top part, which is the civil litigation and special litigation units. While we settle 24% of the cases, 76% are actually litigated to some resolution. In 96% of those cases, the state prevails. The ones you read about in the newspaper are the 4% that we don't prevail in, and as you mentioned earlier, have come up with some pretty high verdicts in the last year and a half. The question you raised is whether or not there's, you know, what the state should be doing, I guess, or thinking about with regard to those high verdicts.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you so much. Ms. Leopold, it's not so much that. It's actually, I'm as interested in the 24% that settle before trial as mm-hmm. I am in the 4% that we lose during litigation. The issue that's before the legislature right now is the cap on non-economic damages mm-hmm. for wrongful death or surviving victims of negligence or other tort claims. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, just as you alluded to earlier in your testimony, people will make a claim of tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
I'm curious in your experience as to, if you had to guess, if they're settled, what percentage of that enormous number do they, what's the range, what's the median, the mode of those kinds of settlements? I understand that there's so many different circumstances mm-hmm. that it's tough to tell, but we're trying to think about a way to manage this in the post-Horton era that's really challenging. And you don't want people who've been harmed either by the state or by private party mm-hmm. through negligence or malfeasance to not have some recourse for appropriate compensation. On the other hand, it's unclear whether multi-million or multi-tens of million dollar verdicts for non-economic damages are a different issue altogether. And I would argue pretty strongly as an aside that I don't think that plaintiffs are necessarily well represented in terms of the economic damages side based on some stories I've heard, but that's a separate issue. So I'm trying to get the perspective of somebody who deals with these claims about how you see this playing out.
Sure.
And I'm highly conflicted, just to be crystal clear about this.
All right. Chair Stark, Senator Steiner Hayward, that's a very difficult question to answer. I'm probably going to give you a real lawyerly response, which falls somewhere in the middle of vagueness. But what you're saying is very common. What a plaintiff asks for within their complaint oftentimes is a number that one might consider to be very fictitious. Mm-hmm. They're asking for the moon and the stars.
Mm-hmm.
What the case actually ends up being resolved for through a settlement or through a jury verdict is very hard to predict, and as you just mentioned, is going to depend on the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about one of the cases in which we did have a large verdict against the state this last year on a wrongful termination claim. In that particular case, the judge, the trial court judge, agree with the state's position and found that there was no claim for whistleblowing. However, the jury had an opportunity to hear a claim that was a jury claim, different than the claim the judge decided. And not only did they give a verdict in favor of the plaintiff, but they awarded $1 million in damages, something that I will frankly tell you none of us anticipated, mm-hmm. not even close. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about, you know, looking at cases and seeing what they're asking for and whether or not they're going to come to fruition in a large verdict rather than a small verdict, mm-hmm. they're oftentimes very difficult to judge. We felt that we were in a very strong position, and the judge agreed with us, mm-hmm. but the jury did not. And came up with a large verdict. Now, these cases where, as I mentioned this morning, I received a $76 million plaintiff's complaint. It was a pro se complaint by someone just by reading the petition itself, has very different ideas about things. And that $76 million prayer is really not something that you would take seriously. Mm-hmm. But we handle those cases just like we handle any others so that we can get them dismissed. When you're talking about the statutes that are before you right now, or the bills that are before you right now, non-economic damages, it's important to remember that those bills are affecting non-economic damages in wrongful death cases. The state is that those bills do not apply to the state. Our caps are designated by the right. Oregon Tort Claims Act.
Right. No, I got that. It's another world to think about it.
Yeah.
You
might have a situation where someone is involved in a car accident with an ODOT truck and they have a sore back and a sore neck. Maybe that's a $12,000 case. But at the same time, you could have someone who is involved in a car wreck who ends up being a quadriplegic. How you would look at those two cases would be very difficult to kind of throw into a norm. But I appreciate your comment that those are very difficult to weigh.
And just so you know, to go along with that, the lack of specific answer there.
Yeah, sorry about that.
On the, you know, in consumer protection last time around in 2016 on the wrongful death economic damages cap, I asked that question over and over and over of both sides of that argument. Mm-hmm. Specifically about the cases that are settled. I wanted to know what kind of settlements were coming, and nobody ever gave me any sort of significant answer on that. So,
yeah, Chairman Stark, let me respond to that in this way, is that the settlements themselves can be very insignificant. Maybe we have made a determination that trying a case through the next 18 months is going to cost the state $200,000 when the party may be willing to accept a very small settlement of $10,000 to go away. You make a business decision as to whether or not you're going to go forward. On the other hand, we have settled cases that have are very significant cases involving child abuse, where at the hands of one particular foster parent, 6, 7, 8, 9 children may have been abused. Well, those settlements are significant, well into the seven figures. So, again, settlements, it's all case-specific, fact-specific as to what's going to happen there.
Right.
Yeah. Now, to give you an idea of how we work to get cases resolved, this pie chart shows you that over half of our cases we get dismissed on early motions. And we do that if we can identify that there are legal faults in the case. We want to get motions to dismiss filed as quickly as we can, and 50% of our cases get resolved that way. In that way, we're not carrying on through extensive litigation. We can get those cases resolved and out the door. But again, over half the cases do not resolve in that way. A quarter of them are settled, as we mentioned earlier. And then of the remaining, you know, quarter of the cases, some of them get resolved on what I'll call post-trial motions, which we call, or not post-trial, pre-trial motions, which we call motions for summary judgment. That's usually after the extensive litigation has taken place, where documents have been exchanged, depositions have been taken, and they can be lengthier in time and more expensive to litigate. Some cases go to trial, and as you see, 14% of the cases result in a verdict for the state and only 3 for the plaintiffs themselves. Our budget drivers, as was mentioned earlier by Mr. Gutman, we have to respond to these cases. We cannot avoid them. If we avoid them, judgments are entered that should not be entered for these folks. So we must respond. Other budget drivers include I'm going to move on to the next one. The complexity of the case. Like the one I mentioned before, while it shows up on our charts as one case, it can involve numerous agencies and numerous individuals who work for those agencies. In addition, some of the cases that drive our budget are very complex because of the high volume of document production that we have to do. Email and electronics, as we use them now in today's world, have created a mountain of documentation. When cases are filed and plaintiffs are asking for all emails associated with a particular individual, for example, we can have 50,000 documents, we can have 100,000 documents. We now measure things in gigabytes and terabytes and things of that nature, and we could have 100 gigabytes of information, which would be boxes that would fill this room. Well, those documents have to be reviewed. They have to be reviewed to determine whether or not they should be produced. They need to be reviewed to determine whether or not there's any attorney-client privilege material in those documents, and it becomes a very labor-intensive exercise, both for our lawyers and our paralegals, and it does drive our budget because it takes numerous hours to respond. Our goal in the trial division is
Senator
to provide...
Frederick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It would be good if you could, in fact, give a sense of how of what kind of increase you are seeing. I mean, you're giving some broad approaches here, but if you are having to go through a gigabyte of material and you need to have staff to do that, how much staff and how many? I mean, you may have to do it by way of not the numbers of papers that you're doing, but I've got a gigabyte of material to deal with. You may be having to measure it by gigabyte rather than paper. That would be, or page. It would be good to know, because I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more of this. And there's the assumption by the general public that you are able to just do that easily.
Chairman Stark, Senator Frederick, I appreciate your last comment that there is a perception that this can be done easily. And it's shared not only by the public, but oftentimes opposing counsel that we deal with. What we have done over the last year is a couple of things. We have hired a e-discovery expert in the trial division who is reformatting how we do things, procedures in how we do things, our responses to electronic discovery, both to keep them more well organized but also as efficient as possible. Some cases are so huge that we have to look at them completely differently than we have in the past. We're involved in this case that is in the papers that involves the county suing the state over timber revenue that they believe they should have received over the years. The discovery in that case is immense. So large, in fact, that we have had to contract with a vendor who provides lawyers to review the documents. And they review them 10 hours a day, every day, for weeks at a time. Our attorney, Eleanor Chin, who is this discovery expert that we retained, we hired, went back, met with the vending company, taught all the lawyers all the issues that are involved in the case, what they're to be looking for, what is responsive, what is attorney-client privilege, and is staying in touch with them as they go through this review process. That's the far end of the spectrum. That is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. On the other hand, when we're dealing with cases of a couple of gigabytes, those documents are now loaded into computer software that helps us sift through them much more quickly. A gigabyte of information, is probably about 10 boxes of information. You would look at an hour to 2 hours per box, depending on the complexity of what they're looking for. But that's, a educated guess as to what you would be looking at in terms of expense when you have mountains of documentation. Of course, we don't measure email in boxes because they just come, as you said, electronically and have, just an immense number. What's difficult with email is chain emails and attachments to emails because someone may ask for all the emails. Well, 17 people may have gotten the same email, and in addition to that, they've gotten that email 17 different times because it's a chain, and so it was once one, then it's two, then it's three, then it's four. all of that has to be reviewed. Now, one of the things that we're trying to work on with opposing counsel in cases is to do what we call deduplicating. The software that we're able to use these days would be able to go through and deduplicate all those emails that you're just talking about so that we don't have to review 17 times 17, but we get to the one email at the end of the chain, and we're able to review that and move more quickly through it.
Again, I think that it would be helpful, not necessarily right now, but in the future, for you to be tracking just how much time, how many people are involved in this process. If you're having to hire a vendor, that needs to be pointed out, that because of this kind of thing, we have to have a vendor outside of the department in order to do this. We don't know that, simply.
And Chairman Stark, Senator Frederick, it was a situation that was completely out of the norm, obviously. But at the same time, we had to make a business decision about the fact that if we had even attempted to do that in-house, it would have taken the work of all of our paralegals and several lawyers, taking them away from the multitude of other cases that need to be handled. So it was the most cost-effective and efficient way of going through the documentation that we could come up with.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have nothing else to present. If there are any other questions, I'll be happy to respond to them.
Are there any other questions? Wow. Well, what's... workload? Did you cover those?
Sorry. I did not get through the rest of them. The next is our policy package that we talked about earlier, that we'll talk about in phase two. I attached a number of things to the package that you received. I'm sure you folks have seen so many charts and so many numbers over the last couple of months. I provide them by way of appendix. You are more than happy to review them and ask me any questions or get in touch with me, and I'll be happy to answer those questions for you. But I don't think we need to go through all of them now.
We normally do CFO today or tomorrow.
It would be
that's what we have.
Tomorrow will definitely be public testimony. So if you went through them today, you'd have a shorter date tomorrow.
Okay. So how about if we do the CFO presentation today?
All right.
And it usually only takes a couple minutes, and that'll give us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Make sure we have ample time for tomorrow.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark and members of the committee. I'm Michelle Lisper with the Department of Administration, Chief Financial Office, and I have a short presentation for you today. Starting off with Governor's priorities. Governor's priority is the child advocacy and for improving child advocacy representation. The governor's budget supports the Oregon Task Force on Dependency Representation and the agency's policy package, which is 132, to address strengthening child advocacy within their existing advocacy section within the Civil Enforcement Division. Other things to discuss on the overview are what we see as agencies' emerging issues, and I've actually grouped them. The first one, improving child advocacy, I've already mentioned. The next one is the state enforcement activities across multiple disciplines, and I address that by dealing with several areas within the agency's budget, which is Medicaid fraud, the MSA, the tobacco settlement, child enforcement, child support enforcement, internet crimes against seniors and children, child trafficking, child pornography, consumer fraud, and DUII prosecution. Other emerging issues are debt collection, which the agency had reviewed earlier this week. Then we have replacement of the Child Support Enforcement Automated System, which they'll go over later. That's their new new system, or the name will become Origin once the project is completed. And then statewide security, what we call statewide security type grants. Those would be like homeland and urban security grants. These are dependent upon the Office of Emergency Management obtaining federal funds to support the grants that DOJ receives, is known as other funds. This chart is the expenditure history for the agency, and some key points to mention here. You'll notice that for the most part I've color-coded it, but some of the key things to bring up are their general fund, which you will see there is a slight decrease in the general fund presented. A lot of this is a part of our reductions in the governor's budget to addressing potential general fund shortfall. The FTE, the reduction in FTE, has to deal with, in part, some of the limited duration positions. You will see a slight increase because of the package that the governor's budget supports for the child dependency does add about 35 positions, around 30 FTE overall. Some of the other differences, it's not one for one, but there are limited duration positions that go away. This particular policy package for child dependency does a little bit of the offset there. And so as we look at the agency by expenditure categories, you can see that 48%, just under 50% of the agency's expenditure by categories, personal services, which they are a service-driven type agency. Agency's budget by program area, this is just gives you the percentage of their overall governor's budget and which of the divisions in the program areas make up their budget. You notice that criminal conviction account I've pulled out a little bit, and that's because that's a general fund. Your LFO analyst just mentioned this earlier, that it's basically an account. It doesn't hold people, mostly trial and appellate charge, against that account to pay for the services that they do, they perform, and receive it as other funds. When we look at the revenue by history, nothing really special here to mention. You can see that DOJ relies on a variety of funding sources. General fund makes up about 13.7% within the governor's budget for this particular agency. And investments, the governor's budget invests in, and I kind of group these as well, strengthening child advocacy, which is their policy package 132 when you review their policy packages. Internet crimes against children is policy, I might have had that one off, I apologize. That one is not policy package one. I need to correct my notes, sorry. VOCA grants, that's policy package 191. That is mostly federal fund limitation for the VOCA grants. I then talk about investments in statewide security. That makes up a number of policy packages, but it deals with their urban area. These are other funds that they receive, mostly from the Office of Emergency Management, Homeland Security, Criminal Information, and their policy packages 142, 146, 147, 48, and 49 that are other funds as you review their policy packages. The Child Support Enforcement Automated System, which is policy package 241, that is be funding for the continuation of that particular IT project. Realigning administrative support and services that were discussed earlier this week by the agencies. Many of these are true-ups, some mandatory IT, state, and federal security requirements, adding some administrative support, reclassification of some positions, truing up where folks were working at a class. The continuation of legal tool projects that is ongoing, that's an IT project that is also monitored by the office, OSCIO. And then enhanced Medicaid fraud through compliance, which is policy package 131, which does have a staff increase. And the on that particular one is about a 75% federal match and 25% state funded. Reductions. Governor's budget did a reduction of general fund of about $10.7 million. Additionally, we reduced the proposed AG rate, Attorney General's rate, from their request of $198 per hour to $185 per hour. Other statewide adjustments would be from the price list and from the Attorney General charges that were reduced based on policy packages that the Department administration did not go forward with, which is pretty standard for all other agencies. And that concludes my high-level review of the governor's budget.
Do you have anything to add? Or Senator Frederick?
Yes. Go back one slide. No, that's the slide right there.
This one?
Yes. Interesting, the call for the reduction in the proposed rate from 198 to 185. What prompted that?
So when Co-Chair Starks, Senator Fredericks, when we review in doing the governor's budget, the agency would produce a list of many policy packages, some of them other funds. And so when we review the policy packages that we're willing to fund, one of the things we look at is, of those policy packages, how many of them will impact the hourly rate for the Attorney General's rate? And the policy packages that we did not support in the governor's budget allowed us to recalculate and present a reduced rate from what the agency initially requested. So in our analysis and moving forward the governor's budget, and these are other funds, not general fund, we came up with a rate of 185, and working with the agency, in essence, that if we support any of these policy packages, how much impacts the Attorney General's rate in affecting other agencies that would have to pay for the rate in those services. That was how we were able to come up with a reduced rate from what their original request was.
Thank you.
And another comment or observation?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, this is one agency where you have to have an understanding of their other funds. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, when the agency bills the Department of Corrections, the Department of Corrections pays that bill with general fund.
Right.
So the other funds, in some instances, not completely, are indirect general fund, lottery funds, federal funds. And when we talk about juvenile dependency, that's especially the case. So just to make sure, the agency budgets perfectly fine as other funds, but you always need to think in the back of your mind of what's the actual revenue source for those other funds. And in some cases, it is general fund. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayward.
Mr. Borden had to listen to me for 4 years, chair of the General Government Subcommittee, complaining about that exact issue, that other funds are incredibly heterogeneous. And that you cannot assume that just because it says other funds, it's not general fund. We end up double counting lots of budget items because of this exact issue. Some other funds mean some of the professional agencies, medical board, construction contractors boards, their other funds are other funds. Those are license fees. Those come from the outside and they don't pass your general fund at all. But it's really frustrating to me, the lack of transparency, where we go about understanding how we double count general fund in our budget on a routine basis. I'll stop grumbling now.
And Michelle, we expect you to solve that problem right now.
You can always cut it more.
And keep in mind, this is also just for the committee as a whole. Specifically with this budget, you notice we skipped through a lot of the reductions that we've mm-hmm. talked about with other agencies. We've asked them to talk about it coming back. As we now go into phase two here pretty quick, if you have other things, whether it's their budget or other budgets that we've come across, please let us know sooner than later so we can have the agency prep to come and respond on some of those topics and issues. So anything else for the good of the order? Well, all right. On that note, we will just really just as a birthday present to Steiner Hayward, we will adjourn.
Thank you very much. My meeting date is please. Thank you very much. My meeting date is
adjourn.